This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, who is here on Mondays and Fridays. While I'm here the rest of the week, today I'm continuing our discussion of the events of 9/11, and I'd like to mention that a rather striking development has occurred in the Scholars for 9/11 Truth organization, which I founded last December. I invited Steve Jones, a professor of physics from BYU, to be my co-chair. And as matters have developed, especially over recent times, Steve and I have had increasingly divergent views about how to approach both the science and the politics of research in this area. I had removed Steve as the co-chair of the society, and now Steve has resigned from the society, and I certainly hope he will continue his research efforts. Indeed, I am creating, sponsoring a conference that will be held in July in Madison now by our tentative plans that is going to investigate the most controversial issues that confront the 9/11 research community. I've invited Steve to create a panel dealing with his approach involving thermite, more conventional explosives. I've invited Judy Wood to organize a panel dealing with the use of high-tech directed energy type weapons. I've invited Morgan Reynolds to organize a panel dealing with issues related to the use of aircraft or not at the World Trade Center. And I've invited George Nelson to organize a panel on what happened at the Pentagon and at Shanksville. In addition, I've invited Barry Zwicker, the brilliant Canadian student of the case, to organize a panel about our critique, the discoveries we've made that show that the government's official position cannot possibly be correct. Now, these issues, in my opinion, although they're controversial, deserve explicit study. I think there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that we have controversies within the community. Steve had a preference for keeping them on the back burner and out of the public eye precisely because they are controversial. But frankly, everything we do in researching 9/11 and bringing our case against the government's official account is controversial already. I do certainly agree that our reputation of the government's account is thoroughgoing and systematic, and that is our primary accomplishment today, to demonstrate that the government's account is not only false, but provably false, and in major respects not even physically possible, because the government's account violates laws of physics, of engineering, and even of aerodynamics. So that is certainly the case, and anyone who wishes to review this series of programs that began a week ago Tuesday will find that on that first occasion I devoted the entire program to reviewing in more than 15 different critiques of the government's account, which demonstrate, in my opinion, conclusively that the official account of 9/11 can't possibly be true. Now, showing the government's account as false is one matter where I think we've accomplished our goal in spades. Explaining exactly how what happened was done is far more complicated and challenging. That's the sort of task which persons like Steve Jones and Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds and George Nelson have been devoting themselves. So I'm very pleased that the scholars are going to sponsor a conference where the details regarding it will be posted on our website at st911.org. Now, one of the most interesting and controversial members of the research community that's devoting itself to discovering the truth about 9/11 and exposing falsehoods is my guest today. He is the former chief economist of the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration. He's a former director of the Criminal Justice Center at the National Center for Policy Analysis and a professor emeritus from Texas A&M University. It's a great pleasure to welcome on this show Morgan Reynolds. Morgan, welcome.
Hey, Jim. Good afternoon.
Real pleasure to have you here, my friend. Could you please comment on some of these more recent developments, if anything strikes you about how where we're going in the community, and especially whether you think a conference such as the scholars are proposing is a good idea?
Well, amazing developments have occurred since August. Things have fast-forwarded dramatically, including Steve Jones' recent resignation, as you discussed. And I'm hoping that he will participate in this conference that you're arranging in July. As we spoke last night, I'm very excited about this. I'm of your mindset in that there's going to be controversies when the methods and extent of the crime, we weren't there, we didn't plan it, we didn't execute it, there's going to be unknown areas, and that's going to spawn controversy. And most of this is healthy as long as we can remain civil much of the time. It's like residing in a department at a university where there is friction, and there's rivalry and differences among departments as well. But most of us found we could survive that rather easily. Some of this infighting in 9/11 has been particularly vicious, but the stakes are tremendous. It's hard to imagine a more important event in the 21st century.
It's ironic, isn't it, Morgan, that they say in academia, you know, the fights are so vicious because the stakes are so small.
Right.
But in this case, it's pretty much the other way around.
It is. It is. It's true that some of us suspect there are active people on the CIA payroll and the other intelligence services. There are moles. Most of this seems to be an innocent mistakes that are really not deliberate, but sometimes it's hard to tell the two apart.
Well, anyone who's interested in knowing, you know, my take on how things stand is welcome to visit our website at st911.org, where you can find not only an announcement about the new conference that's in the works for this coming July, but also an anniversary statement about reorganizing the scholars in a more formal fashion by incorporating as a nonprofit and by creating a board of directors who will have the responsibility for overseeing those who maintain the website, the forum, and the journal, and who can, you know, exercise appropriate responsibility in a supervisory capacity. And I think that should be a step that we are all going to welcome, including me. Because I found I've been devoting, 8 or 10 hours a day to all these matters, and it's extremely taxing. So I'll be quite pleased if we have a board of directors that can shoulder a lot of the responsibility involved here. Let me just add, Morgan, that of course I know you would agree, but a lot of students may not realize the nature of science, that the simplest explanation that can account for all of the available evidence, or that can provide a cause that is appropriate to the effect, is a preferred explanation in science. The principle is known as Occam's razor, but the fact of the matter is it must be the simplest explanation is preferable only when it can account for the full range and extent of the evidence. And in this case, something I very much want to talk with you about during our next segment is the massive devastation of the World Trade Center. And the role of the bathtub here, this enormous kind of barrier within which the World Trade Center was constructed, and damage to vehicles that were in some cases as far as anywhere from a half a mile to a mile and a half away, which seemed to me to severely press explanations in terms of conventional explosives, even if you combine thermite with different types of conventional explosive RDX and so forth. It's not clear at all that it could possibly explain this phenomena. I know you've been doing a lot of work with Judy Wood, Morgan, and I want to invite our listeners to places where they can observe the photographs of the devastation that we'll be discussing when we return momentarily. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. I'm here with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, the former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, and today an outspoken critic of the administration in relation to 9/11 and a wide range of other issues, including the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Morgan, let me mention for the benefit of our audience that there is a website, a series of studies, including massive set of photographs that you have put together with Judy Wood, which can be found by going to st911.org and scrolling down to the date of 29 November. If you get to 29 November, you're going to see a whole series of studies that have been put together by Judy and Morgan, And below that, a piece that I will mention later, could HARP have been used at the WTC? And below that, something I want us to turn our attention to during the next segment, Morgan, why indeed do the WTC buildings disintegrate? But let's start with some of what you and Judy have put together here, Morgan, in terms of records and photographs related to the massive destruction of the World Trade Center. Could you tell us a bit about your work with Judy?
Well, I certainly can, but let me do a little preface here, and that is that when it comes to controversial issues like what brought down the Twin Towers or planes, were there planes, were there commercial planes crashing at the four designated sites, my approach is to put aside whatever the government or the corporate media have told us and pursue the truth in a timeless, apolitical way. And to me, the short-run salability of whatever I come up with is immaterial. I'm concerned about the long run. What's the real truth here? So put aside all that and then look at the evidence with a fresh eye, okay? And you want to only really consider reliable or valid evidence, not planted evidence or various kinds of deception or fabrications, okay? So it depends on human judgment here. And that's what Judy and I have tried to do here with regard to the Twin Towers, okay? And Judy is the dominant scientist here. She's got the science and engineering background, and she is more visual than Morgan is, and put together a great series of photographs. Now, one of the most important things about why these data or this evidence about what happened at the World Trade Center is so important is that these photographs, for the most part, are not disputed. Everybody accepts the evidence here regarding the dust clouds, for example, or the bathtub, which you mentioned, and I'll turn to in a moment, or what happened with the path tunnels or the rails. In other words, we've got a photographic record here, and unless somebody shows us where we're wrong, that a particular photograph has been faked or manipulated, we've got a very coherent and extensive record. And what these photographs are, and to some extent videos are can do for us is tell us, lead us to the truth about what happened here.
Let me just concur with your observation, in particular that when you have inauthentic evidence or fabricated photographs or documents or records, it's indispensable to be able to sort them out from the authentic, the genuine documents, because that can create chaos if you're unable to do that. In the course of over a decade of research on the death of John F. Kennedy, for example, the best qualified individuals to ever study the case, our principal task was precisely sorting out the authentic from the inauthentic evidence. And once we had established, for example, that the autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal, for example, a massive blowout to the back of the head, that a brain, someone else's brain had been substituted for the brain of JFK during a second supplemental autopsy report, and especially that the whole movie of the assassination, which many take to be the closest thing to absolute truth in relation to the death of John F. Kennedy, the Zapruder film, had been completely recreated, where major events had been taken out, the timeline had been constricted, so if anyone took it to be authentic, then they would be placed in the impossible position of trying to reconstruct what had actually happened in Dealey Plaza based upon a false assumption. So I think everything you're saying is completely correct, and that in other contexts, I have had to deal extensively with that type of problem. Here, to the best of my knowledge, there's much less of a problem with fake photographs and so forth, but they may crop up in crucial cases and have to be dealt with and sorted out.
Right, and of course the plane videos are much disputed.
Yes.
But if we go to the bathtub, actually I learned about this, and I believe Judy did, only in the August-September range. And this started us down this path of an article that has now got the Star Wars beam weapon label. We were going to call it something about the protective bathtub, But that became only one piece of evidence, but it's a very important one that started us off looking at the wider set of effects that occurred on 9/11 at the World Trade Center and the surrounding area. So this bathtub, I know in the interview you had with Dr. Judy Wood, you discussed this, but in brief, what it is this tremendous barrier that is below ground some seven stories down to bedrock. And the principal purpose is to protect the foundation for the World Trade Center, especially from the water seeping in and undermining everything that's built there. And the most remarkable thing is that despite this mass destruction, the incredible Independence Day destruction that occurred on 9/11, the bathtub was essentially intact. It suffered very little damage. And that's remarkable when these towers are so massive and powerful and were destroyed. If all this material that was in each tower, and while it's disputed exactly how much they weighed, this encyclopedia estimates were about 500,000 tons each. Now, imagine 1 million tons, the two twin towers, smashing down on this bathtub, and yet it was undamaged. Well, that's impossible, virtually impossible.
In fact, my understanding is, Morgan, that even using, you know, heavy equipment to try to remove some of the rubble, that it was potentially damaging the bathtub, just that heavy equipment. So
Yes.
They had to take great pains in how they were cleaning out
some of the minor
so
damage.
Wouldn't further damage it.
Right, was by these moving vehicles, these earth machines.
Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer with the Dynamic Duo. We're discussing the events of 9/11 with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. And we're trying to find out exactly what happened at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Morgan, I might mention, for those who don't know, if they go to 29 November and start checking out the website that you and Judy put together, if they go to the first page called Star Wars Beam 1 and scroll down, they'll see a diagram of the bathtub and its function in relation to the Hudson River. And if they scroll down further, they'll observe a number of photographs, including a particularly striking one, figure 9, of the nearly cleaned out bathtub. Now, I want everyone to appreciate the immensity of the problem that would have arisen if the bathtub had ruptured and flooded. It would have, just 3 months ago, I was in New York at Cooper Union for a 9/11 event, and on the 11th itself, I was at the World Trade Center subway stop taking a PATH train over to Newark, which, of course, goes underneath the Hudson River. So if you had had this a breach of the bathtub, it would have not only flooded the bathtub, it would have flooded the subway system of New York and the PATH train under the Hudson River, and it would have undermined the foundation of many immense structures in that vicinity. I mean, the cost would have been staggering, hundreds of billions of dollars is a conservative estimate, and I would conjecture it could take maybe up to 10 years to clean up the mess. So, Morgan, I think everyone needs to appreciate that this is an enormous problem here, in the sense that there could have been quite a catastrophe that was somehow miraculously averted.
Right, and if you can, if we can put aside the concentration on the data, let's just conjecture here. Where is the financial center of the world?
Of course,
let's say City of London is a competitor, but Lower Manhattan is, I would claim, the center of the financial world. And you'll recall what a rush the government and the powers that be were in to get the stock exchange reopened the following Tuesday, I believe it was, the following week. So within days, they reopened the New York Stock Exchange and related exchanges. Now, if Lower Manhattan had been flooded, which would have happened here had the bathtub not been preserved, you can imagine the kind of financial outfall from this, not just the physical damage down here in Lower Manhattan. It would have disrupted the entire world financial system. So a reasonable conjecture is here that the perpetrators actually took this into account.
Well, I think that that's probably correct for the at least several reasons. I mean, the relatively undamaged bathtub, which isn't to say that it had no damage, but it had no serious damage. It had no ruptures. It didn't allow water to come flooding in, which was the crucial question. So it continued to perform its essential function. Obviously, if the official account of some kind of pancake collapse were true, then you would have had something approximating between 500,000 tons and 1,000,000 tons of mass collapsing onto that bathtub, but it couldn't possibly have survived that kind of impact. Moreover, therefore, it not only is the pancake theory refuted, but the very idea that there was any type of demolition that would have brought down a mass between 500,000 tons and 1,000,000 tons. I mean, something has to happen to that mass, does it not follow?
Certainly, yeah. One of the most striking things to me was, looking at this carefully, was the lack of debris. You know, where are WTC 1 and 2? There wasn't but even a story. You could barely cover the ground. By contrast, WTC 7, which most of us believe was a conventional demolition, where it was collapsed symmetrically into its own footprint, the debris there is over 5 stories high. In other words, that makes some sense. You need at least, the debris pile should be at least 10% of the original height of the building. That would mean that the debris pile should have been a good 11 stories at a minimum. And we don't see that. And furthermore, they didn't fall in a below ground level either. By the way, now we have a nice diagram on this first page of the article we're talking about, which has a cross-section view of the Hudson River, which is at ground level for the World Trade Center or Lower Manhattan generally.
This is a figure.
And when you're 7 stories below, it's easy to see how the river water could flow in there.
Well, some apologists for the government would say that, you know, that this doesn't take sufficiently into account, though you mentioned something about this in passing, that there were all these sub-basement levels. So they might claim, well, the whole building compacted down into those sub-basement levels, and that's why you can't see it.
Well, there was some damage down there, but Judy likes to point to the Roadrunner as being an intact guy, and that was in the mall. Of course, they had a shopping mall there at the first level of this. Basically, it was a ground level, that first concourse level.
Right.
And building 4 was above it, and building 4 was a 9-story building, and that thing was wiped out virtually. And then you'll recall the South Tower tipped at the top and was threatening to fall right on that where Building 4 was, and suddenly it just basically turned to dust, you know, as the initial part of the destruction of Building 2. Well, the point is that you had two large buildings, one of the tallest in the world, destroyed right above the Warner Brothers store down there in the shopping mall. It's right under that. So while there was some destruction in the sub-basements, it was not massive. We've got evidence to that effect.
Yeah, just to elaborate on your allusion to the Roadrunner, anyone who scrolls down to figure 18A and 18B on Star Wars Beam Number 1 will see these rather large figures that I think were they ceramic? As I look at them,
well,
like Bugs Bunny and others, figures from Warner Brothers.
They do look, at least in part, to be of, yeah, they look like they're all hard materials.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah. You'd think that if under those conditions they would have to have been crushed or shattered into a large, you know, a lot of little pieces,
right.
A few large and a bunch of others, but they're intact. That is rather stunning.
Right, and you can see that they preserved the rail tracks for the PATH train that you rode over to Newark.
Yep.
Those weren't eliminated or destroyed, and they when they reconstructed over there with newly refurbished platforms, etc., the tracks were the same. That is, they hadn't moved. And then, of course, under Building 6 over there on the northwest side of the big bathtub, the parking structure, they actually retained that. You can see that in a lot of our pictures here.
Let me ask you this question then, Morgan. You know, William Rodriguez, of course, who was a senior custodian of the North Tower, has reported of a massive explosion in the sub-basements there, which has been confirmed by some 36 other custodians, where one of them had most of the skin ripped off his body. William reported the explosion occurred before the plane hit the North Tower, and now Craig Furlong and Gordon Ross have conducted a study based upon what it appears to be very precise information about the times at which the seismic effects of the explosions of this kind appear to have taken place and when the planes hit the building. And they discovered that those sub-basement level explosions were taking place as much as 14 and 17 seconds before the planes hit the building. Now, how does this relate to your views in relation? We'll pick up with this question about how this relates to Morgan Reynolds' views about what happened at the World Trade Center when we return to the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, where Kevin Barrett hosts Monday and Friday, and I'm here the rest of the week. This is a continuation of a series of programs devoted to the events of 9/11. I have today my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, who, in my opinion, is one of the most interesting and brilliant students of 9/11. Within the research community as a whole. We're talking about the events related to the World Trade Center, the bathtub, how it's astounding that these two 500,000-ton buildings, if they'd actually collapsed onto the bathtub, would have caused fractures that would have led to the flooding, not only of the bathtub, but of the path, train tunnels, the subways, and much of the underground beneath the lower Manhattan, which, as Morgan has been pointing out, is like the financial center of the universe, which means that the dimensions of a catastrophe could only begin to be measured in terms of pure physical damage. Morgan, the question I was raising is, with your and Judy's observations about portions of the sub-basement areas, including the Warner's studio store, having artifacts that were undamaged when one would expect they would be, you know, shattered to pieces, are you suggesting that the reports we've had of sub-basement explosions, such as William Rodriguez has reported, that were even as much as 14 to 17 seconds prior to the impact of the planes on the building, did not occur or were somehow restricted in their scope?
Three-point response, Jim. Let's start at the top, because you mentioned planes. I've got to jump on that.
Oh, sure.
There were no Boeing planes that hit either tower.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need a whole separate show on this. You mentioned I'm a controversial researcher. There were sudden gashes in the building, right?
Let's put it this way. William Rodriguez reported that the tremors that he had...
Well, I want to respond to that.
Were subsequent to these massive explosions.
That's number one. So. You take it for granted that the Boeings went in the buildings. No, they didn't. Secondly, yes, there were explosions. For example, Rick Siegel's movie, his Cinema Veritas record.
9/11 eyewitness.
There's no question that there were explosions. Now, Willie Rodriguez is a man I trust. I've been with him, and don't doubt his testimony. In addition, we have, for example, I've seen the photo of his fellow worker with the skin falling off his body.
Yeah.
So I don't doubt the explosion. So we have lots of evidence that explosions occurred. Now, there is no necessary conflict between that observation, and I think the facts are overwhelming regarding explosions in the each tower, but there's no conflict with that and the idea, the hypothesis that we strongly suspect is what went on, is that some kind of directed energy weapon actually turned most of each twin tower to dust.
Yeah, before we get there, let me ask just this point of clarification. You're suggesting that these explosions that took place in the sub-basements, to which William Rodriguez, among others, has testified, and there's photographic evidence, of course, of the damage to the lobbies and all that appears to have been a consequence,
yes,
and the demolition of this 50-ton hydraulic press and all that.
Mm-hmm.
How do those relate to the Warner Studio store where Roadrunner is undamaged? Is he far enough away that these explosions, I mean, which sub-basement is that in?
The Warner store and the mall there are beneath the South Tower. Willie was in the North Tower.
Right.
And so there's no necessary conflict there.
Well, presuming there were explosions in both sub-basements, or are you questioning whether that might be true?
No, I'm not. I'm basically saying, hey, I don't doubt explosions in both of the towers. Yeah, but they weren't sufficient.
The function of that explosion, would you agree with my surmise, namely that it was to dislodge the 47 core columns from the bedrock?
I don't know that. I doubt that. I haven't thought that through.
And you doubt that because of the damage
but
you might have done to the...
If we go back to the...
If we go back...
In our article, we actually have a couple of photos where... Ground Zero workers are going through the mall.
Yeah.
And while there are things hanging from the ceilings, etc., you can see that one of the storefronts, for example, is plainly visible, called Innovation. So the damage there at the mall appeared to be light from what we can see. So that's not inconsistent with explosions going off. These explosions simply weren't big enough to make this huge damage that you're proposing.
Okay. Well, I'm just very interested in, you know, drawing that.
Even when they talk about
a
50-ton press, as I understand it, they aren't talking about the weight of this steel machine. They
right,
are talking about
the capacity of the press.
Yes, right.
The shape,
right.
Metals up
yeah.
to 50 tons.
To exert
pressure.
50
yeah.
tons of pressure.
Right, so I understand.
What it weighed, who knows? You
yeah.
know, it might be a 2-ton or
right,
1-ton
right,
type
right.
machine.
Yeah, in terms of its actual weight.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us more, then. I mean, begin wherever you want. I mean,
well,
you know, and of course, let me say, for the sake of our audience, I mean, I have an enormous admiration for Morgan's intellect, which does not mean that I agree with everything he says. I'm fascinated
right,
by
right.
the working in Judy of Dunn. And,
that's the story of my career, Jim. I'm used to being in the minority. I'm very comfortable.
You know,
I'm comfortable that way.
Yeah.
But... here's the next bit of evidence that
uh-huh.
we treat seriously, and that is, what about the seismic disturbance? The seismic disturbance appeared to be modest if we go by the public record. That is, the crash of the South Tower, it was equivalent to a 2.1 on the Richter scale,
right.
according to that the Columbia University
correct.
Monitoring station.
And the North 2.3.
And for the North Tower, it was a 2.3. So this is something you can feel, but it's not enormous, and it seems to be far below what it should have been had 500,000 tons of material crashed.
Yeah, I think Judy calculated it should have been upward of maybe 3.8.
Yeah, that's right, in the 3.5 to 4.0 range, which is quite a bit larger than the 2. So, and then we do some analysis comparing it to the kingdom, et cetera.
Right.
Now, this is subject to revision, of course, but it's another data point that looks to be fit the bit larger picture. In other words, there wasn't enough of a seismic disturbance here to be to fit the idea that there were 1 million
yeah, there were
tons of
collapse,
of material
all
collapse there. That's
tons
right.
came down with each building. That something seems to have been mitigated the force.
That's
of
right.
Mass.
Of what
I mean,
should have happened.
Of course, obviously, would have been that mass had been converted into energy or deconstructed by some technique or other.
And this is a good point at which to mention the government theory, and that is NIST. The National Institute of Standard and Technology insists that, we're going to model this, and right up to the initiation point of this gravity-driven pancake collapse, which says all of this material should have crashed onto the bathtub. Well, where did they get that from, right? Where's all the material, for one thing?
Right.
And if we look at the dust that went up, with the destruction of these buildings. Judy's made some calculations here that say, hey, we have just about the right amount of material that's turned to dust and covered all of Lower Manhattan out into the bay and the fringe areas of Brooklyn and so on. So where did all that dust come from? Those are the twin towers suspended in the atmosphere.
Oh, I know, Morgan. You know, people don't believe it. You look at that little clip, for example, where you have one remaining spire that seems to be turning to dust before your very eyes, and people say, ah, no, you know, steel doesn't turn to dust. But you have to ask yourself, well, the whole damn building is gone. I mean, it's been converted into dust. What do you think? Steel can't turn into dust? Then where did this huge, massive cloud of debris come from? I mean, that's
it was
so
not only
was,
the concrete
was pulverized, turned into
not only
particles
the concrete,
of dust.
Right,
lock, stock, and barrel.
Mm-hmm.
As you have said in your memorable phrase, "Blown to kingdom come," and from the top down. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back with my guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where Kevin hosts Monday and Friday, and I'm here the rest of the week. Today, I'm continuing a series of programs addressing the issues of 9/11, the events there, what happened, what could have brought it about. Today, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, a former chief economist of the Department of Labor, a professor emeritus from Texas A&M. And Morgan, another whole area we want to explore, and of course I'm glad to go back to any of these issues we've already been talking about, is these so-called toasted cars, which seem to be distributed in many different locations far removed from the World Trade Center, some on FDR Drive, for example, that are anywhere from a half mile to a mile and a half. I mean, that's just stunning that you look at these vehicles and they're twisted and they're burned and some of them are, the front half is all mangled and the back half is all perfectly normal, and you think about the poor drivers who had to be incinerated when they were, you know,
behind
the wheel.
You don't want to think about that. Right. Hey, let me dress back up, and we'll get to the toasted cars in a couple of minutes. But first of all, on page four for listeners who can go to the website, on page four, about one third from the bottom, we have a lot of photos regarding underground damage going down in the holes and sub-basements and exploring the damage in the parking structures and the mall. And just to sum up, we're not saying there wasn't damage down there. In parts, there surely were. For example, one of the PATH trains had three or four of a seven-car train damaged, but three of them were intact. Three or four, I can't recall the exact number, but seven were total. So it's a mixed picture there. And then, are you still there?
Yeah.
Are we still here?
Yes, we are. We are, Morgan. Go.
Okay, we had an audio problem there, but I can hear you again. Now, there's a second thing regarding page four that I want to point to, and that is about one-third down, we have a picture that's just captioned figure wall. And what this shows is the remains of the north wall of WTC-1, the north tower.
Yes.
And it's right alongside Building 6.
Yes.
Building 6 was an eight-story building. Now, what is I want to call your attention to here is that about 10 stories of the outer wall there of the North Tower are still standing. They're kind of leaning over the Building 6.
Right.
The remarkable thing is, where are the other 100 stories? You don't see the steel from those upper stories sitting in the hole in Building 6. The debris stack there is at most, four stories, I would say, leaning up against the right-hand side of that wall. So it's just remarkable. What happened to the building?
And I take it that's a relatively low stack on the other side of Building 6 going up the street. That, you know, I mean, looking in relation to the building, that's
okay.
Not even one floor
that's
high.
On the left-hand side of this picture there, and hence on the north side of Building 6, is Building 7. That's the debris pile. Now, it doesn't reach quite as high as Building 6 there, which is eight stories.
Uh-huh.
But it's a solid, on that top of the picture, it's a solid five stories. I'd guess it to be six stories high. So that makes some sense there. In other words, you didn't disappear most of Building 7. We haven't done a real careful analysis of 7, but that's our preliminary take on Building 7. You look at that tower. Where the heck is the tower? Of course you see some steel debris, but it's just not nearly enough.
Yeah.
And then finally you mentioned the toasted cars, which are on the next page, 5.
Yes.
And you summed it up well. Blocks away. Now, some of them are close by. Some of the emergency vehicles were close by or at the World Trade Center itself. But what is so remarkable is to see them, the damage to some of these vehicles out there on FDR Drive. And we have added a little map to show you where FDR Drive is, which is along the east side of the lower Manhattan and hence alongside the East River.
Yeah, look how far away it is for the World Trade Center. I mean, this is stunning, Morgan. How could thermite or thermate used at the World Trade Center cause this damage to these vehicles over on FDR Drive?
Yeah, that are a half a mile away. It's just, I don't see how that could happen. And it points to some kind of unconventional happening here.
I do think this is some of the most powerful evidence that something very weird was going on and that no range of conventional explanation is going to work here.
Right. So some of the you showed or talked about some of these bizarre effects, like it shows the remains of the steel belts from radial tires, but there's no rubber left.
Yes.
We have a car upside down in front of an SUV, or you have these peculiar burn patterns where it looks almost as if the asphalt under the car is on fire.
I just want to encourage our audience out there, you've got to go to see these photographs. I mean, they're just so stunning. You got to go to st911.org, scroll down to 29 November, then go to the fifth page, Star Wars Beams 5, and scroll down and look at these pictures of these vehicles and how they're mangled.
Right.
Remember, in most of them, there were human beings inside those vehicles. They had to
in
be
many
cremated.
Of them. Yes, yes. And it's hard to think objectively when you realize some of these people were just incinerated or vaporized. Another peculiar thing is that often you see missing engine blocks or the front end of the car where the engine is on fire, but not the gasoline fuel tank.
Isn't that bizarre?
It is.
So fascinating. I can, you know, to get an explanation for that is a great challenge.
Right, yeah. Now, here's a whole other area that is covered in this article, and that is these anomalous vertical holes that seem to have been almost drilled or, vaporized material. Building 6 has a huge, maybe 40% of it is missing.
We're talking about page 4, I think. Now, you want to go to page 4, everybody.
Yeah, that would be
these,
page 4.
Buildings, all kinds of photographs showing these massive, as it were, carved out, virtually surgical extraction, as it were, from these buildings. Go ahead.
Right. And there are some of these. There's one kidney-shaped hole that is in Building 5. But the ones that really impress me on some of these outbuildings, these lower buildings, are Building 3, which was the Marriott Hotel. That was 22 stories. There's a big, almost V-shaped cut, a missing part of the building.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then, after that was after the destruction of the South Tower. It's standing there, this remaining 60% or so of the Marriott Hotel. Then, after the disappearance of the North Tower, the Marriott Hotel is reduced to a mere scrap of what it was. It seems like a 3.5 stories of part of the building. It's just amazing. And then most of Building 4 has been disappeared, all but the north wing of it. You know, you just say, hey, there's very little scrap steel down there at the bottom, and that's where some of Building 2, the South Tower, remains were. So it's just incredible disappearance of steel here.
Fascinating. So I'd like for you to give us part of your critique as to why you think conventional explanations, even those involving thermite or thermate, can't possibly account for this all this evidence, all these...
We'll go there.
We'll begin. We'll address that issue when we return with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. This is your host, Jim Fetzer, on The Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where The Boy Wonder hosts Mondays and Fridays. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist of the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, but a decided, outspoken critic of this administration in relation to 9/11 and other events. Morgan, please continue.
Well, I gather you were going to go right to the bottom line here, which might be premature, but the toasted cars are a fascinating bit of evidence, and there were some 1,400 of these toasted cars. So there's no gainsaying that this did happen.
Let me frame the question since I didn't carry it over from our last segment. Namely, my question is there any way that the evidence we've been looking at here and discussing with you can be explained on the basis of conventional analyses of the kind of causation that even Thermite or Thermate might have provided?
Well, of course, I do not see how that would be a satisfactory explanation, because thermite and its variants, as I understand it, are steel cutters.
Yeah.
And even if they had an explosive component, etc., that would set all 500,000 tons of each tower or something in that neighborhood right down in the bathtub.
It would be another way of bringing about a pancake collapse.
Right. And while thermite might have been involved in the destruction of these twin towers, I'm not saying it rules it out. It's just an unsatisfactory. It's inadequate to account for the breadth of this evidence.
Now, my presumption would be, Morgan, and I think you probably agree, that we're talking about multiple forms of causation, that you could add one type of explosive, for example, in the sub-basements, then you could have had, say, like a high-tech directed energy weapon, maybe taking out most of the mass of the weapons, and then if you had maybe 20 floors left, that might be brought down using thermite or thermate.
Right. They aren't mutually exclusive. But
that's right. It's too easy to slip into thinking that it's an either-or proposition.
Right.
Thermite, it couldn't have been anything else, when thermite might be a partial explanation for part of the damage, but not be able to explain for the totality of it.
That's right. But to go back to the beginning, you know, the way we started, it looks like to keep this bathtub intact and to keep the seismic disturbance small, you'd have to disappear a lot of material. In other words, have it dustified. Had it turned to ultra-fine particles and carried away into the atmosphere.
Converted at least into some form of mass that would be innocuous in relation to the potential problems caused by all that solid mass.
Down there on the ground, right.
Yeah.
And now this demanded some kind of high-energy device, or devices, plural. And that means that you would ordinarily look to some kind of nuclear explosion or some kind of high energy or directed energy weapon. And the mini nuke type device doesn't seem very appealing. Because it, unless this were all delicately applied in multiple mini nukes somehow, it would seem like you're running a high risk of damaging seriously the bathtub, or and then of course the flooding that goes with it. Maybe you're not getting. Here's another aspect that kind of puts a nuclear device in the shade, and that is. We had a lot of aluminum facade debris thrown on to nearby skyscrapers.
Yes.
But we didn't have steel ejected above the 20th floor. So a nuclear device, it wouldn't seem like it could be so selective as that. It would have blown steel for many hundreds of feet, if not a couple of miles, right?
Well, and when the buildings start to blow up from the top down, now don't we see steel beams being blown outward and even upwards there at that point?
There were some of that, but It doesn't seem like it was a large quantity. And like I say, it was only from the lower levels that this stuff was ejected.
Let me ask you this now, Morgan. Paul Olmholt, who I had on yesterday, had raised, when he first heard my first interview with Judy, which was back on the 11th of November, raised the question of, you know, what would be the source of all of the energy, because Judy was speculating that either by way of a mirror reflection or from some kind of possibly space-based location, this energy could have been funneled or directed. She pointed out that as long ago as 1991 that the military was reporting a successful experiment in which a low-energy laser was directed at a mirror and brought back down to the Earth with a degree of accuracy within 3 meters of its intended target, which was considered to be quite a success. Now, that was back in 1991. Now, Rolf put it this way, that there was an electrical cord reaching up to the to a satellite that could produce that energy, which made me think about World Trade Center 7 and how, of course, it came down late in the afternoon at 5:20 after Larry Silverstein said perhaps the best thing to do is to pull it, which, of course, was erected over an enormous power substation there in providing electricity for lower Manhattan. And it seemed to me, well, if you need a source of electricity, maybe that's it. And that might explain why, you know, 7 had to be destroyed later on, if it could have been somehow related to as a source of energy, which might have been beefed up in terms of providing the weapon or the instrumentality by means of which the rest of the floors were brought down. And more recently, I was contacted by a television station, the INN World Reports, about the possibility that it could have been some kind of deuterium fluoride laser that apparently packed such a wallop that you could mount a weapon that could do this sort of job in a 2.5-ton truck. Now, if that's not striking enough as an alternative, then, of course, we know the HARP system can produce, or is intended to produce, something like 3.6 gigawatts of effective radiated power, high-frequency radio energy, that could then be delivered from a satellite in a quantity of energy comparable to a nuclear bomb anywhere on Earth via laser or particle beams. I mean, this kind of stuff suggests that we're not really talking about far-out hypotheses, but about not science fiction, but what may well be simply advanced technology that's a fact today.
Right. Judy and I don't want to be that specific because we don't have enough evidence to discriminate among all these competing technologies. And I don't think anybody can. But we're all headed down the right path. Here's what I think is the most important thing. Regardless of the serial numbers or the platforms or the exact kind of HARP optics or energy source or accelerator, what's important is that it could only have come from our own military-industrial complex.
Very nice point, Morgan. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. Stand by. We'll be right back. This is your host, Jim Fetzer, on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where the boy wonder can be heard on Mondays and Fridays. Today, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, we're discussing the World Trade Center and its destruction on 9/11. Morgan, you're a big picture kind of guy. I'd like you to take, say, 10 minutes to give kind of an overview, what you would like the American people to know about the evidence we find at the World Trade Center. And then the next segment, I'd like you to address, you know, what actually has happened here from a political, historical point of view.
Oh, gee whiz, you're going another direction. Let me make a couple of narrow points, and then we'll go big, okay?
You got it.
First, this article, I call it a project, is a work in progress, and it's not finished yet. I don't think we're going to change our mind drastically about where this evidence leads, but we got to leave that open. Now, it's been controversial. Lots of people have weighed in. And one of them, one of the objections is they say, oh, this is preposterous, this is space beams and other nonsense, or even, you know, ET, space aliens. Well, I just want to make one point about that, and that is we've got a lot of references here that shows, and you've already reviewed some of these, in a way we have too many candidates. The technology exists to do this. One of the ironies to me is that I'm a subscriber to Sirius Satellite Radio, I get my TV and the radio off the satellite. Now, we aren't even claiming that we know that an energy weapon came from a satellite platform. That's not necessary, okay? So that's just a word to our critics. Now, two more small things, if you will, I want to point to, although nothing really is small about any aspect of 9/11. But on page 6 here, I think there's a couple of really striking things that I want to point to. The first is something that hasn't taken much of our time so far, and that is Building 7. Building 7 was destroyed by a different means than the Twin Towers or the other outbuildings of WTC. And we have, just below the middle of page 6, figure 91, we have a pair of photos, Jim, that are really striking to me. First, the first photo shows Building 7 pre-destruction. And the bottom photo from the same aerial type view shows it after destruction.
Pretty stunning, isn't it?
Isn't it? Look
how down into its own footprint, into its
exactly.
own basement, just exactly.
It's just with hardly a mark on the two adjoining buildings or neighboring buildings.
Yes.
On the right is the postal, federal postal building. On the left is Verizon. Isn't that incredible? It's almost like you could drive on either side of the debris there.
Yeah, that's right. I hear there are only a half a dozen companies in the world that can bring down buildings with such precision.
I know. I was struck about how perfect the videos, I think there are three, how symmetric that collapse was. And by contrast, that landmark hotel that they brought down in Fort Worth, Texas a few months ago, might be 6 months ago now, how that one tilted a little. But this one, 7, was brought down. There was never a more perfect controlled demolition in history. And then below that, we have something that I think we need to mention regarding the evidence at the World Trade Center. Figure 94 shows the only file cabinet recovered from the site. So this reminds us again, and you can see how
which building, Morgan? Do we know?
I don't know what building or what area it was recovered from. But look at that thing as melted and shriveled and compacted, yet the file dividers survived it. See that blue and
the file and the blue and the red.
And this of course points to the unburned paper in the street where you have burning cars but the paper isn't burning.
Yeah,
these anomalous effects. But the filing cabinet, the lack of office furniture and machinery and a body and body parts and on and on.
Yes, chairs, computers, living things, including human beings, they've all been...
Right, these buildings were disappeared virtually. The Twin Towers were. They didn't go in a controlled demolition the same way Building 7 did.
The government, of course, plays a game with that phrase, so they say it can't be a controlled demolition because they weren't blown up from the bottom up, but of course that's just equivocating. Controlled demolition means a demolition that was under control, that was systematic, that was designed, that was intentional, and that
certainly
obviously is the case with the Twin Towers.
Yes, the Twin Towers were a controlled demolition. It was just a much different form of destruction.
That's right, top-down, very sophisticated, using some multiple kinds of, of energy sources, et cetera.
Right, and they were what I call dustified, whereas 7 wasn't. In other words, a heavy majority of both the Twin Towers were turned to dust and carried away in the atmosphere and eventually formed this 1 to 3 inch snow on the ground.
You know, Morgan, some of the critics claim that the film clips that show that spire from the North Tower turning to dust, they claim actually it's just some dust coming off of the spire as the spire collapses. But you see, it seems to me that contradicts what we're watching in the large. I mean, we're watching those buildings turn to dust, and those buildings are mostly steel. So the steel has to be turning to dust. We just happen to catch a few fragments of watching it happen before our eyes.
There simply is not enough steel by an order of magnitude or three orders of magnitude at the bottom there.
Yes.
there just isn't the kind of steel. Each tower had an estimated 100,000 tons of steel. You don't see 200,000 tons of steel stacked up there.
Right.
So it wasn't just pulverization of the concrete in the floors. It was virtually everything in the upper stories, above the 20th floor, and including the steel was turned. We have a lot of evidence here in terms of videos and photos that, to me, show vaporization or dustification, where steel turns to steel dust. I don't see how anybody can deny it unless you're kind of working for the other side real hard.
I want you to get to the big picture because I think you're so good at that.
Well,
what was going on here? I mean, we can begin and then continue after our next break. Tell me, what was going on? What was happening on 9/11 in relation to, you know, the political and historical and economic development of the United States? What was going on here?
Well, I think there are two levels. One level, we have the visible government, and the other is the deep politics, the non-superficial, the invisible government.
Yeah.
And they're a little harder to read, and this is very speculative. But let's just take the first level.
This is the sort of thing that Peter Dale Scott pioneered in his work, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK.
Right, yes. And I'm borrowing his language. I like Ray McGovern, the ex-CIA analyst, who may not be the best on 9/11, but as he said, it was about OIL, the acronym, where O is for oil, I is for Israel, and L is for logistics, for the Global Domination Project. And that covers a lot of this big picture motive. 9/11 was a happy new Pearl Harbor for the visible government, the Bush-Cheney bunch, Rumsfeld et al., Wolfowitz. And you know just as well as I that they've been public on that with the PNAC document, right? That
the New American Century. We'll pick up at that point with Morgan Reynolds, my special guest today. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on a Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can hear Kevin on Monday and Friday. Today with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist for the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration. That's right. He was in the Bush administration himself. But now he's a severe critic on many counts. Morgan, let's continue our conversation here. Please, you were mentioning Project for the New American Century, which, of course, was a neoconservative think tank that involved a lot of persons who had become major players in the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Donald Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, even Jeb Bush was a member.
Mm-hmm.
Please pursue. And, of course, they were sketching a project, a plan for creating a worldwide American empire greater than any the world has ever seen that included moving American forces powerfully into the Middle East to dominate not only natural resources, but as you suggest, to benefit Israel and to promote this ideology.
Yes, and I think we've got to realize that these people are not like you and I or the listeners. They've got power, fame, big money, control on
most
their minds.
Most of it's our money, isn't it?
Yeah. And kind of their historical reference are Alexander the Great or Genghis Khan, that kind of competition. So they want to outdo those people. And besides the oil, Israel's place, or the greater Israel and the logistics for the Global Domination Project, of course, they're also at the surface is narrow profiteering. Right? You have the Larry Silversteins who make out just great financially. Or you have a handful of people who had puts on UAL or AMR that morning, okay? Or somebody got away with some gold bullion. So there's that, too. But let's pull back from that for a minute and just say, how is this fiction, the official government conspiracy theory, going to wear? Well, we have already seen it's not going to wear well. It is such a lame story about 19 Arab ne'er-do-wells pulling off the biggest military attack in history and against the greatest air defense in history, and on. It's just absurd. And all of this is an Independence Day type event, a Pearl Harbor attack on the homeland, to create a war, a synthetic war with the Muslim world, which really doesn't have any validity whatever. And that's not going to wear well either. Although you stack up enough bodies, look at how many the U.S. government may be responsible for in Iraq alone, right? It looked pretty convincing.
Yeah, estimates as many as 650,000.
Yes, and it looked like they did a pretty good. They used all the valid survey methods, but more generally, okay. Then we go to this elite. Who's the power behind the Bush-Cheney administration? Isn't going to be there forever. They really aren't going to be able to impose a fascist state openly and stay in office and suspend elections indefinitely, I don't believe. So, but yet, you know, these governments come and go, but nothing seems to really change. A lot of this looks to be democracy that doesn't really exist, or the original republic idea. So,
and this is really getting at the deep politics
that
you and Bill Scott are alluding to, ongoing institutional interests that may be bureaucratic but largely corporational in character, where the
world
states and globalization may all be in the mix here and try to promote the best interests of these multinational corporations rather than, say, the citizens of the United States.
Of some kind of elite, a privileged elite, a powerful, wealthy elite. And here we end up, of course, debating, because it's a pretty shadowy area where you don't have much open, valid evidence. You know, is it the Bilderbergers? Is it the CFR? The CFR is too big and diverse, I think. For example, the Council on Foreign Relations got over 4,000 members. Or the Trilateral Commission, or, you know, you get into this financial oligarchy that got Stephen Jones into trouble as if it were some kind of a religious or ethnic type, you know, oh, it's the Jews, or it's the Jesuits or the Pope or whatever. Well, I don't know about any of that, but I do know there is some kind of a sustained elite here that does profit on the misery of others. I mean, that's pretty apparent to most of us.
Yes.
And let me get one last thing in here, and that is that the corporate media are a mouthpiece for the evils being perpetrated by the worst part of our government, right? Including 9/11 is most obvious. I can remember they scripted this thing at the top. They were in on it. That takes me to the most controversial area of all, which is the planes at the World Trade Center area, where they were in hand in glove on this. Or if you just take a look at one thing comes to mind here, where Aaron Brown was on the top of 5 Penn Plaza broadcasting for CNN. They were about, I think it's 2.5 miles north of the World Trade Center. And as the North Tower is being destroyed, and you got that one corner section of it still there,
mm-hmm.
and it's turning to steel dust, and he says something like, it's almost as if he were on the inside. I'm not saying he is or was, but it's almost, and he said, oh, and there's dust coming off there. That thing was disintegrating before his very eyes. And he was telling the viewers one thing while their eyes were seeing another. Well, which one is more powerful? I think it's the words are more powerful.
Morgan, please tell our listeners what you think they can best do to advance the of truth and the national interest in this strange time.
Well, we all have to do something. That's don't just stand there, do something. Now, I think all of us have our different skills and interests and aptitudes, but tell a friend, give them a DVD, right? Tell them, send them to st911.org or go to my website, nomoregames.net. First thing, of course, you have to do is educate yourself to a reasonably high level and head on out. Get a group going in your town or contact a 9/11 activist group. Do some research, right? I mean, So I'm not sure how this can be best played out so that we get our ultimate aim, which is justice for the victims and their families, the survivors, the nation, and the world. I mean, we are basically a rogue superpower run amok and doing so much harm, and most of this could not be accomplished without the sanction of 9/11 and the myth of 9/11. So we've got to destroy the myth and push truth as best we can discover it.
Well, Morgan, I want to thank you and Judy Wood and everyone else out there is doing their best. I must say, to me, it was such a stunning revelation to confront the full dimensions of the devastation that was wrought on 9/11, not just involving the Twin Towers, the North and the South, but and Building 7, but 3, 4, 5, 6. And when you start sorting it out, the massive devastation, together with the improbability that those enormous buildings could possibly have hit the bathtub without fracturing it and cause of extensive flooding of the PATH train tunnels or subways, and not to mention damaging the foundation of other massive buildings. And when you consider those vehicles, you mentioned 1,200 or 1,400 vehicles scattered around the city, some as far as a half a mile to a mile and a half away. It's increasingly, overwhelmingly obvious that mere conventional explanations, even those that appeal to thermite or thermate, are hopelessly inadequate to account for the totality of the damage. And to that extent, I think it's very reasonable to infer that when you recognize scientific reasoning is based on analyzing different possible causes in relation to their effects and assigning them probabilities if the cause were operative, I think just as in the case of plane impacts and jet fuel fires and collapse, the probability of these effects is approximately zero. When you throw in thermite, thermate, you're only accounting for part of the evidence, a very small part. It certainly can't account for it all. You're going to have to be forced in the direction of a more complex explanation involving some kind of very sophisticated weapon with which we're generally unfamiliar before you get an hypothesis which, if true, would confer a reasonably high probability on the quantity and quality of devastation wreaked there. I want to thank Morgan Reynolds for being on with me. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Come back, come back, come back. Tomorrow, my special guest will be David Ray Griffin.